You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
I'm Anthony Painter. I'm director of the Action and Research Centre here at the RSA. And I'm delighted to welcome you all today for this RSA Thursday lunchtime talk. I'm delighted to welcome our guest speaker today, David Goodhart. He's the founding editor of Prospect Magazine and one of the most distinctive voices on British politics and society. He's currently head of the Demography, Immigration and Integration Unit at the think tank Policy Exchange and was previously director of the centre-left think tank Demos. His last book, The British Dream, was runner-up for the Orwell Prize in 2014. David has been a brilliant and provocative voice on issues of identity and nationhood for some time, since a famous Prospect essay in 2004, Too Diverse, with a question mark, on the risk posed to social solidarity and the post-war social contract from historically high levels of migration. He has forced a sometimes complacent liberal worldview to listen to wider voices than their own social and political circles. And in his latest work, The Road to Somewhere, he provides a battery of evidence and historical analysis to alert to a more society which may become too divided for comfort. He's always a voice worth listening to. Please welcome David Goodhart.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony. We have agreed and occasionally disagreed about some of these issues over the years. I'm very glad you included the question mark in Too Diverse, which many people often leave out. Anyway, I'm here to talk about the book I've just written, The Road to Somewhere, which does seem to have struck a bit of a chord. I've been very lucky with the publicity surrounding it. Some of you may have seen some. I think it's partly because it's sort of the first book that's turned up that attempts to provide a kind of bigger story about the instability in our politics, partly evidenced by the terrible events yesterday, but the broader instability and division in our society represented by the Brexit vote and indeed the rise of UKIP, the first real populist party breakthrough into our politics. I mean, this is a serious subject. My one sort of joke on the subject is my 10-word version of my thesis, explaining why these value divides have had the destructive impact, a destabilising impact that they have had. The 10-word version of my thesis is this: I blame the masses for Brexit, but not the masses that all the left-wing professors in my timeline are blaming. I blame mass higher education and mass immigration for Brexit. And I will explain why as I go on. It's not a very funny joke, you're right. The book is essentially, as I say, about value divides in British society. You could say it's a kind of book about social psychology, a very sort of underdeveloped discipline in many ways. And I have created this rather colourful couplet, the people from anywhere and the people from somewhere. And, of course, that sounds very basic and binary, and I will explain why I think it is still of value. What do I mean by the people from anywhere and the people from somewhere? The people from anywhere, as I think you can probably guess, tend to be highly educated, mobile, value openness and autonomy, and indeed benefit from those things, tend to be wary of group attachments, and don't tend to feel them very strongly themselves, tend to have a kind of a worldview, a political worldview that I call progressive individualism. They represent 20-25% of the population, growing partly because of the growth of higher education in recent years. Against the anywheres, you have the, well, not necessarily against, but sort of alongside the anywheres, you have the somewheres, who tend to be much more rooted, tend not to be so well educated, tend to place a high value on group attachments of various kinds, and indeed value familiarity, security. I mean, of course, anywheres do too, to some extent, but they place more emphasis on it. They represent about 50% of the population. There are obviously subdivisions within both of these large value blocks. I talk about the more extreme anywheres. I call the global villages. They represent about 5% of the population. At the bottom end of the somewheres, there is a group between 5 and 7% who I call hard authoritarians, genuine xenophobes. And there is a big, did I say this already? There's a big group in the middle, the in-betweeners, who are about 25%. Now, overlapping with my categories is a very useful distinction, I think, from the American sociologist Tolker Parsons, who some of you may have had to read as students if you studied sociology. I remember, I have to admit, I've never really read any Tolker Parsons. I do remember my sociology student friends all grimacing when his name was mentioned. He wrote these kind of chemistry books of sociology. But he did come up with this very useful distinction between, or rather he described identities, human identities, being on a spectrum between achieved at one end and ascribed at the other. We all have a bit of both, obviously. But anywheres overwhelmingly have achieved identities in the sense that their sense of themselves comes from their educational and career success, their sense of what they have, their sense that in a sense they have made themselves. Obviously, no one has made themselves completely, but they have that their success gives them that sense. And if you have an achieved identity, as perhaps most of us in this room do, it's become sort of portable. Your sense of yourself, you can carry around with you, and so you can kind of live anywhere. You can live amongst people who are very different to you without feeling discomforted. Whereas if you have mainly an ascribed identity, if your sense of yourself comes from the particular place that you were born in, the groups that you belong to, you're a Scottish farmer, a Cornish housewife, whatever, then your identity, I think, is more sort of vulnerable to being discomforted by rapid change. So, you know, somewhere identities, people with somewhere identities, I think, tend to see change as loss, whereas anywhere people tend to ride the waves of change and manage that, indeed thrive on it in many cases. I invented these labels. I did not invent the reality of what people feel. I spent a lot of time going through the British Social Attitude surveys and other value and opinion surveys, and these blocks do exist. You might want to give them different labels, but they are, I haven't invented them. They really are out there. Obviously, it's a kind of fluid thing, but if you just take, you know, if you look at, you know, a lot of the opinion surveys relating to openness, and particularly to what we're really talking about here is socio-cultural politics rather than socio-economic. Indeed, the reason why, you know, at some level, you know, talking about anywheres in some ways is sort of banal. We all know that. You know, you have a highly educated, you know, people who tend to be more mobile and tend to be a bit more liberal. We've always had them. The reason why this has become so much more important now or recently is because the balance of power has shifted. The numbers have changed significantly. Anywheres never used to be a very large proportion of the population. I mean, they were always disproportionately influential, obviously, but until relatively recently, they were no more than 5 or 10% of the population. They're now, I would say, 20, 25% and growing. And that has sort of unbalanced the system. British common sense used to be pretty well entirely somewhere common sense, and anywheres sort of adapted to it. And now, over the last generation or so, anywhere common sense is now the dominant common sense, I would say. Not unchallenged completely, it is true. You know, the two largest selling daily newspapers, after all, the Daily Mail and the Sun, are very much more somewhere than anywhere. But if you look across the whole spectrum of politics and policy, you can see anywhere-inspired policy everywhere. you know, almost everything you look at. And trying to think of somewhere-inspired policy is really quite hard. There are some areas, not particularly attractive areas. The fact that our prisons are overflowing is undoubtedly a recognition, a political recognition of the rather draconian approach to criminal justice that many somewheres have. Household welfare caps is another one I thought of. I mean, beyond that, I struggle actually to find areas of policy where somewhere intuitions, you know, until Brexit came along, and of course that's part of the problem. So, you know, large proportions of our population have felt excluded from daily politics and, you know, and have stopped voting. Millions of people voted in the referendum who had not voted in general elections for very many years. So as I say, the reason why this has emerged now, or relatively recently, is because essentially because the numbers have changed. Just, you know, very briefly, sort of skating over the policy fields in British life, the huge expansion of higher education, the decision that seemed to have been taken 25 years or so ago to put all our baskets in the university, to put all our eggs in the university basket, and the continuing decline of technical and vocational education. I mean, I know, you know, particularly here at the RSA, this is a very ancient story, but I think it's got worse in recent years because of Anywhere domination. Anywhere's, including most of the political class, I mean, more than 90% of MPs now are graduates. The vast majority of people who make decisions in our society went to Russell Group universities. Their children go to Russell Group universities. This is a world they know and understand and value, and rightly so. It's a great success story. And they simply don't know enough about the other stuff. I mean, the fact that we threw away these prestigious technical organisations, institutions called polytechnics, because the, 25, 35 principals of them, perhaps one of you is one of them, or was one of them, went to Ken Clark, decided they wanted to be universities, because universities are more prestigious than polytechnics. And Ken Clark, a Cambridge man, thought, well, of course, you know, we all like universities, of course you can become universities. So we now have, instead of prestigious technical institutions, we have relatively low-grade universities producing piles of research that nobody ever reads. I exaggerate slightly. of course, a lot of them do vocational work. It's true, you know, they train nurses and surveyors, and you know, they play a very important role, obviously, in British society. But it is that decision in 1992, I think, is a symbol of what I'm talking about. I mean, in economics, I mean, we talk about the knowledge economy. As if that's not problematic. I mean, the knowledge economy works for people who are highly qualified and highly educated, and we have, I mean, not deliberately, but we've not really lent sufficiently against the trend, I think, towards a much more, what does one call it, hourglass labour market. I mean, the kind of hollowing out of a lot of the middle skill, middle status, middle income jobs, partly a function of the decline in manufacturing, of course. The extraordinary openness of our economy and society, a great benefit to all sorts of corners of British life and to many of us. But I think sometimes we forget how radically open we are. I mean, if you compare WTO the intrusiveness of WTO rules into international life compared to the previous GATT global trade arrangements, I mean, it's really quite remarkable. And it makes it much harder for countries to sort of express their national preferences, actually. I mean, there are all sorts of areas of life where there are big differences in national traditions. I mean, over risk-taking, for example. I mean, you know, we tend to be quite happy with perhaps wrongly, with riskiness in financial products, say, in a way that people in Austria and Germany aren't. And, you know, some countries have very different views of whether they want to experiment with GM crops than other countries. And yet, you know, you end up being sort of homogenised by these things and losing national choices. That's one aspect of openness. I mean, and mass immigration, of course, is another, perhaps the most visible aspect of the very great openness of British society in the last 25 years or so. I mean, there was we've had historically unprecedented levels of immigration since 1997. A great new surge after 2004 with the East Europeans, Central and Eastern Europeans coming 7 years before it was necessary to allow them to come. And this openness has worked for some people. The commercial lawyer who can go and work in Paris or Berlin for a couple of years and, you know, doesn't feel threatened by minimum wage East Europeans back here. But that isn't true at all if you work in the food production sector. I was talking to a Tory MP just yesterday who represents one of the Norfolk seats, and he says, he described to me this town, I think Waltham, is there a town called Waltham?
Swaffham.
No, I don't think it is Swaffham. I think it's near Swaffham. Anyway, it's a kind of one-horse town, of a, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 people possibly, and it used to be a kind of one-factory town. There was an old family firm who ran this. It was a pig factory, basically. I mean, they took in pigs and sausages came out the other end. And it used to be, you know, without romanticising it too much, it used to kind of have its kind of working men's club, and it had a decent pool table. And then it was taken over, I think, about 20 years ago by a more bottom-line focused, I think still British, multinational food company. And kind of sort of life went on more or less. It was perhaps a little bit bit harsher. You know, maybe the pool table wasn't so good. And then, after 2004, there was quite a big factory, employed about 900 people. Since 2004, 800 of those 900 people come from Eastern Europe. They live in hostels in King's Lynn. They send back a lot of their money to wherever they've come from. Can't blame them. You know, this is the system that we have allowed to develop, and they have taken advantage of it, and good for them in a way. But you know, if you're one of the people that used to work in that factory, you might think that the national social contract is not working for you in the way that it used to. Of course, that openness and that loosening of the national social contract, you might say, has had some very positive benefits too. The fact that companies can, you know, have been able to employ anybody from the European Union, a huge range of skill levels, it has saved companies. I mean, one of the factoids that I don't think has actually been discussed enough, but one of the factoids I think that does illustrate, you know, just how much the national social contract in labour market and training terms has been damaged by freedom of movement is the extraordinary figures on the decline of spending on training by British employers. It's declined, according to a paper by Francis Green at UCL, it's declined by more than a third, I think, over the last 15 years. Yet the time spent on training has declined by about a half. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Anyways, so mass hour education, the knowledge economy, openness. I would also put the kind of the anti-domesticity bias in family policies is perhaps the most controversial aspect of my book. I mean, I think the fact that we spend £8 billion on childcare every year in Britain, and yet no woman, and it is mainly women, is allowed to look after her own child from that funding pot. It seems extraordinary in a way. I mean, lots of other countries have sort of care allowances. We've significantly downplayed some traditional roles, I think unnecessarily. I mean, it's quite possible both to support equality in the workplace, including, you know, at the higher echelons, to support more women on boards and so on, while also respecting other choices that British women want to make. 70% of British women support the idea of the so-called modified male breadwinner. In other words, they want a decently earning man when they have young children and are bringing up a family. And yet we make it actually, you know, we've done very little to make that, you know, we've focused so much more on women on boards in a way. I mean, even the Conservative Party, it seems that they felt that in order to get a hearing in kind of modern liberal Britain, they had to talk much more about women on boards and about the destruction of the working class family. Anyway, I think in all these areas we have what we've experienced, you know, what I call a kind of liberal overreach. Essentially anywhere interests have been expressed in perfectly good faith, you know, anywheres think that they are acting in the national interest when they're acting in the anywhere interest. Of course they're acting in the national interest too much of the time, but in some of these areas I think there has been insufficient recognition of the value division and the different priorities that these significantly different groups have, and not enough of an attempt to bridge the gap, as it were. And I think, you know, this is why we've had a kind of legitimate populist backlash, and this is something we could perhaps talk about. It's for all sorts of reasons it's hit the centre-left particularly hard. I don't want to sound too pessimistic. I do think that the final chapter in the book, I think it's probably the weakest chapter, but it is called The New Settlement. You know, what is it? What are the bridges that can? It wasn't that long ago. I think probably, you know, the mid late 90s, early New Labour, I think did still have a kind of ear for appealing to both somewheres and anywheres. But since then, I think we've whichever party has been in power, I think we've rather lost it. And we've now had a smack in the face with Brexit. I think my final point is that I think there is a very important debate going on within what one might call the anywhere class, the political end of the anywhere class, between those who are somewhat remorseful, like me, who are saying, we've screwed up here, and we've got to listen to people more, and we've got to try and find bridges between these value groups, otherwise our politics is going to be permanently unstable. And the kind of what one might call the AC Grayling anywheres, who are saying, my God, you know, we've got to dig in here, they're barbarians, and we're the good guys. And I think it's the outcome of that debate that the future of our politics hangs. Thank you.
Thank you, David. It's a fascinating analysis, and there's a stack of evidence in the book. But by the end of it, I find myself thinking, are we in fact not more united than the framing allows for, but also more divided? Now, I'm going to take those points in turn, and we'll deal with the united point first of all. And what was interesting, this appeared in a minor comment in the Casey report on segregation and integration. There was a government survey called the Community Life Survey. And there's a fascinating question in there about attachment to nation and your opinions about the place in which you live. And 89% of respondents in the survey have strong attachments to Britain, to nation. Yeah. And the same proportion think the areas where they live in are places where people get along. And so it seems to me that actually there is a far greater commonality. There is a far greater attachment to place that we all have, anywheres or somewheres. And we kind of think the places that we live in are kind of working, and we're happy with that. So I wonder, coming on to the anywheres, first of all, whether actually the anywheres that you're talking about are the global villagers, in fact. And it's a much smaller group than 25% of the population. It's nearer sort of 5 or 6%. And there are there's a big portion of somewhere anywheres, and the somewhere bit is still significant in that somewhere anywhere group.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think we are in some ways more united. I mean, just Nigel Farage and Nick Clegg are both liberals in a pretty fundamental sense. They both believe in the rule of law. They both believe in minority rights. They both believe in checks and balances on power. I mean, sort of historically speaking, they would have both been regarded as liberals. I mean,
of course, they're liberals rather than political liberals.
Yeah, but they both believe in certain core liberal principles, I would say. And I think there's a very broad agreement on the basic outlines of what our society looks like. You know, we have a broadly free market economy, highly regulated free market economy. We have a very big state by historical standards, a 40% state, and a public space with a pretty egalitarian and sort of permissive ethos that most people sign up to. I mean, I don't think I mentioned it, I call the somewheres, excluding the more extreme hard authoritarians, decent populists. And, you know, if you look at the data, most of the great liberalisation in cultural attitudes, whether it's race, sexuality, gender, and so on, somewheres have, I mean, anywheres may have been in the kind of vanguard of it, but somewheres have gone along with most of it, yeah, most of the time, perhaps a little bit more slowly and a bit more reluctantly, often seeing some of the negative unintended consequences of some of these changes. But your point about community life surveys, I mean, look, I've just written a book that's full of survey evidence, so I can't go around rubbishing surveys, but there are some surveys, I mean, there are some questions that are better than others. I mean, you know, if someone comes up to you and asks you, you know, do you think people get on? It's such a kind of vague and general. I mean, there's lots of other data that says people are very worried in certain parts of the country about lack of integration of minorities and so on and so forth. And we know through just watching people's behaviour through, you know, sort of white exit or white flight from areas that that become very minority dominated. You know, people do move, but you know, because they feel uncomfortable if their school becomes majority minority. Not everybody does, but a lot of people do, and I think that's a legitimate feeling, by the way. And it's something, you know, if you assume, as you know, our form of multiculturalism was a very asymmetrical one. It was, you know, minorities have identities, but majorities don't. Well, obviously, everybody has an ethnic identity. It's different for majorities than it is for minorities, and obviously the majority is itself subdivided into all sorts of different regional and class and other groups. But if we pretend that people in the majority don't have feelings of comfort and discomfort and a way of life that they're attached to and so on and so forth, then we get ourselves into a very messy situation.
I wonder what actually, I mean, there is some evidence equally that diverse areas have a greater degree of social cohesion and trust. Very diverse areas. And this is, you know, there's been some research done using metropolitan police data. What it shows, interestingly, is that those who are older don't have the same sort of feelings of trust as those who grew up in diverse environments. And there is a feeling of cohesion in that environment. Because I think, I mean, the other thing I was going to say when I was going on to the how I wonder whether we're more divided than the somewhere versus anywhere framing allows, is this somewhere group. It seems very big to me, a 50% of the population. And the sort of hinge point for me in the analysis is when you talk about the percolation of socially liberal attitudes, even amongst the somewheres. And actually, you kind of observe it as a historical thing that's happened, and that's it. But I wonder actually whether it explains something rather more. And actually what you're doing is grafting together different groups with different attitudes. So what unites all the somewheres might well be a scepticism about immigration, I think quite clearly. That is a majority position in the UK. It might be something about attachment to authority, and it might well be something to do with scepticism towards elite. But what doesn't unite them is a feeling of community, tradition, rootedness, you know, in a sort of in many of the communities that we can all recognise, because there actually is a far more individualistic, ambitious, aspirational, mobile in professional terms and in cultural terms, whatever, that you're lumping in the somewheres alongside a far more traditional group, and you're creating a group that I don't think actually really is can be coherent.
Mm. I mean, you may be right, but I mean, and it may be that, you know, all these. I'm assuming a similarity between all these sort of groups of 50 or 60% who appear to be uncomfortable about much of the modern world, and that actually there are lots of different groups. I think there is a consistency across them, though. I mean, it's 62% of people say, it's astonishing, you know, that famous survey question about, what is it, you know, that Britain has changed very fast in recent years. Some people say that it feels like a foreign country, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. 62% of people agree with that. I mean, it's just astonishing in a country as sort of successful and stable as Britain. And only 30% of people disagree with that statement. The standard, I mean, just this point about the groups, the standard immigration survey question that has been, the results of which have been pretty steady over the last 10 or 15 years, 75% of people think that immigration has been much too high or just too high, and 25% think that it's either at roughly the right level or we want more of it. We want more of it is the global villages. It is about sort of 4 or 5%. The it's about right, I would say, the anywheres, and it's about 23% to 20%. The people who think it's much too high are, you know, broadly speaking, the somewheres, yeah. And the people who think it's a bit too high are the in-betweeners. I mean, it just happens, that one happens to fit perfectly in my schema. But there are lots of other...
But there's lots of reasons for being sceptical about immigration. Some of them are because observed, you know, community changes. Some of them are about, you know, you are concerned and anxious about your own position, whether it's access to public services, housing, jobs and work. And so sometimes these, and they do interact, but they may be coming from very different directions, actually. And I think it's key to get underneath some of the general questions.
But I do think you're also wrong to say that the academic evidence suggests that diverse areas have higher trust. I mean, the absolute You know, there may be one or two sort of freak surveys, but you know that from Robert Putnam onwards, the working assumption.
That's US data.
Yeah, I know,
UK,
I know. But James Lawrence and other people.
Yeah.
Exactly. I was going to say, Sturgis. What are you doing down there? You know, James Lawrence and.
Can I just say there is a difference? We've got to distinguish here between segregation and diversity, and the evidence does suggest different levels of trust. There are and I'm going to come on to this point because I think it's a key one. Because where I think you hit the nail on the head, and then you maybe don't expand it as much as you could, is when you look at three different experiences of diversity in the UK. And this is really interesting stuff, and it's in one of the later chapters. And you have this typology, one, areas that have become segregated, you know, the Oldham Burnleys, just to pick obvious examples. Areas that have become, you know, very diverse, hyper-diverse. We're talking sort of Hackneys and Leicesters. And then there's communities, maybe suburbs of London, that are starting to feel increasing diversity. And so you've got three very different experiences of diversity and change there. And I just fear in the national conversation, on one side, we've got a group of people who are emphasising the virtues of hyper-diversity. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got people saying, whoa, look at the dangers of segregation. And what we should be doing is actually looking at the nature of the places themselves and thinking what the right response is, rather than saying this is our national story of diversity and integration.
I'm trying to disaggregate the concept of integration in a way. I mean, I think, you know, I think integration is important. I think we haven't got it right always in the past. And I think it's very difficult to know what to do about the kind of milltown places now. I think it's... I think it's very difficult to know what to do that have these entrenched divides in the mill towns and places like that. But I think that what we should be focusing on is making sure we don't reproduce that story elsewhere in the country, in those places, as you say, in the Swindons or Milton Keynes or the Solihull, or those tend to be more affluent and relatively middle class places where the problem tends not to arise so much. Learning from the mistakes of the past and making sure that somehow, you know, we kind of lean against too much clustering of minorities, and that you know, we don't allow schools to become too much either all white British or all Pakistani or whatever. In a liberal society, it's very difficult to do that. But governments are now worrying about it. We had the Casey report. And I thought a lot of the analysis was quite good. I mean, the recommendations were a bit fuzzy. But, you know, like I say, because, you know, in a liberal society, it's very difficult to tell people who to be friends with or even where to send your children to school. But the point is that it's a kind of horses for courses thing. So, you know, there are different parts of the country where the issue arises in different ways. Sorry.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of a useful texture for thinking about how we go forward. Now, the chapter you said was in your opinion the weakest, I thought was one of the strongest actually, because it was very interesting. And you kind of come to this point where you have this sort of, you know, give the somewheres a voice, set of propositions, political propositions, even sort of policy propositions. And a lot of it seemed very sensible to me. It seemed to be rooted in social justice, that we should invest in, you know, vocational and technical education, apprenticeships. We should seek to devolve power and so on. We should look at political reform to ensure that we can give voice to the sort of diversity and pluralism that I think is a more accurate picture of modern UK politics. But it seemed to me that the give somewhere's a voice manifesto was easily something that the anywheres could sign up to. And I just wonder whether actually, again, by understating the degree of unity and commonality, we're missing a trick here.
Well, no, I mean, the chapter is called The New Settlement. The whole premise of it is that there is the possibility of a settlement and bridges can be built across these value divides. It wasn't that long ago when I think... back, as I say, in the kind of mid late 90s, when there was we had a political movement that did seem to take both groups with it briefly. And I think it's interesting that, again, back this is so much, the divisions are so much more in the sort of social cultural field than in the socioeconomic field. Indeed, in socioeconomics, the value surveys suggest that there's been a great convergence actually between. Between anywheres and somewheres, you know, between the kind of the middle class and the working class, which not quite the same thing, but the working class has become less statist, the middle class has become more egalitarian, you might say, over recent generations. So that actually there's on political economy, there's really quite a big consensus. But on the cultural issues, we've diverged in the last generation or so, and that is the problem. But the bridges, I think there are bridges to be had, as you say, in things. I mean, I think actually proportional representation, although it's not the kind of thing that some wares tend to be very interested in, indeed it tends to be a minority interest even amongst any wares, as we saw from the referendum. But actually, proportional representation, different forms of voice locally, you know, PR, giving a populist party, giving UKIP or some equivalent to UKIP 30 or 40 seats in Parliament, I think would be great. I wouldn't vote for it, but I think it would be great to have that voice represented in our National Assembly. And the environment is the other thing I talk about as a possible bridge area. I mean, it's a bit less worked out, but I mean, I just think at a sort of slightly macro level, that somewheres settled people who are connected to place, perhaps in a way that some of the more global villagey anywheres aren't. And connection to place is a sort of inherently green thing in some ways, or you could say that greenness is, you know, that there's a sort of conservatism about greenness, about conserving places and respecting places. I mean, I'm not talking so much about sort of subsidising tidal wave power or whatever, but just in that sort of basic sense that greenness and somewhereness are allies.
Okay, well let's open it up to the audience.
Hi. First of all, I would say that I find your ideas very interesting, and it's something that I've had a lot of sympathy for a while, partly based on Ferdinand Mount's book, Mind the Gap, and also the Blue Labour Movement. But I think one thing that you touched on at the end that I find difficult about it, and I wondered what your thought was on the balance between this idea of kind of acknowledging the failures of liberalism or anywhereism or whatever one you want to call it, and kind of defending against movements which do worry me that have come out of Brexit and Trump in the US, and how you find a balance where you kind of put your hands up and say, we've got some things wrong, but actually some of this at the heart is right and I want to defend it. And in the context, particularly of your comments of being kind of proud of being post-liberal, I suppose.
Similarly, I really, really respond to the anywhere-somewhere divide, clearly as an anywhere, but actually see the disconnect in actually how politics are working. My specific question, though, is looking historically, do you actually see any kind of historic basis for this kind of divide and almost how as a society we got out of it or any other society got out of it? Because I still am troubled by actually what the future looks like.
Thank you.
We live in a world of soundbite and language is extremely important to us. The word populist, and I'm not saying this is my view, but the word populist to a large percentage of your somewheres could sound dismissive. It could even sound demeaning, and I'm surprised that it's not been replaced. Already I've thought, listening to your talk, David, a number of other words, but I think a historian 50 years from now, if he looks back and he sees the word populist, he'll say, what did that mean? And I think we need to get another word in there. I mean, value revolt is one. Peasants' revolt we had the Cuban revolt, the Orange revolt, the Glorious Revolution. We in this century have chosen populist revolt. It's so disappointing and doesn't tell you anything at all.
Good thoughts. We need an emotionally intelligent liberalism that speaks to a much broader group of people than those who call themselves liberals. obviously, I think I'm trying to prevent the development of more. I think there is legitimacy in much of what might call the populist backlash. It does have many ugly forms. There is kind of acceptable populist parties. I think UKIP is one of them, perhaps the Danish People's Party. And there are really pretty frightening ones, and Wilders and others. I don't really know what I think about the National Front in France. But I think, if you don't address some of these feelings in democratic societies, people will protest, and they will often find themselves voting for demagogues who they may not even really support themselves. They're kind of voting for them, as a counterbalance. I think a lot of people who vote for UKIP don't necessarily, well, certainly don't want UKIP to form the government. but it is literally a protest vote. And they want that voice to be heard and to have an impact. You know, it's kind of, you know, in many cases, it's often, to put it in another way, it's kind of less successful people trying to restrain more successful people who are governing too much in their own interests. And in some ways, I mean, leaving aside the kind of technicalities of the single market and so on, you could say that actually the Brexit vote, I didn't vote, I mean, I was a Remainer, but the Brexit vote is a long overdue rebalancing in some ways. And it's sort of democracy working. I mean, referendums are very, very kind of rough and ready things, and it'd be far better if we didn't have to have referendums, you know, if the mainstream political system was already giving voice to those priorities and sentiments. On the historical point, yes, I mean, I think we are in a new situation in that, you know, we are, you know, all sort of rich, developed societies, in that we've never had so many highly educated and mobile people. So I don't think there are that, you know, well, of course, you know, you go back to, you know, 1920s, 1930s, we had the kind of, you know, people who were highly sort of disconnected from the kind of normal feelings of the population. I mean, you know, there's a sort of Bloomsbury group type of people who were, you know, highly individualistic and sort of countercultural. But that, you know, they were a couple of hundred people. Of course, there were many more people who would have, you know, would have thought in, perhaps in roughly similar ways to them. But you know, we're now talking about tens of millions of people who don't necessarily think like the Bloomsbury group, but you know what I mean. They're a sort of that's why it's different, and why we have to worry about the disconnection between these groups, I think. And the language point, yeah, I mean, I think you're right in a way, but we're kind of stuck with this word. I mean, I try and subvert it slightly by using the phrase decent populism. I mean, I think a lot of some words are decent populists.
Which said values revolt, everybody who heard it would think about the most important thing to everyone, which is values.
Yeah, yeah.
Populism says nothing.
Yeah, you're right, yeah. Values revolt. I mean, it does sound a bit like the Peasants' Revolt. It does sound like the Peasants' Revolt.
Why
I mean,
not do that? Why not
talk about the population? Okay, well, I will talk about the values revolt. I do. I mean, I do sort of think, I mean, this is, part of me thinks that this is, the Brexit vote was the last great act of the English working class, actually. I think someone should write a book, From Chartism to Brexit. It was, you know, as they kind of disappear beneath the waves, it was the last wave of a very important historical and social group.
Let's have another bank of questions.
Thanks for a really interesting lecture. My question is about the tension between evidence and emotion and where a future vision might come from. So it seems to me that people make decisions, particularly around Brexit, in the face of the evidence. The 350 million NHS bus is just a complete load of tosh, and at the same time there's plenty of evidence from the anywhere class that, you know, the mass of the immigration that we've seen has been economically beneficial for this country, and as you can tell from my accent, I'm one of them. So I guess my question is, if people are making decisions on an emotional level about their connectedness to their identity and to their sense of loss, where does that connectedness, where does that emotional vision come from in the current political landscape? You suggested that Tony Blair had it in the early to mid-1990s. I can't see anyone in the current Labour Party offering that. So where do you think that kind of emotional vision for a different type of settlement can come from?
Here for some time on that question, this gentleman.
Yeah, thank you very much. One of the things I have to say, I am a very long-term advocate of Britain's leaving the European Union, so this year is a triumph for me, personally, as a long-term campaigner, and one of very few in the academic world, as you would know. And that's right. And I want to make just two comments quickly, if I may. First of all, as a campaigner on the doorstep, that everybody I engage with who told me they were going to vote to leave approached it on the basis that they wanted their country back. And that phrase was used time and time again by all sorts of people from all ranks of economic success and failure. So, and within that, there was a very clear reason, and that was the dispossession was felt much more acutely among English people than among Scottish or Welsh, who are universally seen to have had their share.
Okay, thank you. I just wondered, you've partly alluded to this, whether you feel that this situation is replicated in other countries of Western Europe.
I mean, yeah, good question on the kind of how to bring evidence and emotion together. I mean, would be rather a good definition of good policy in some ways, wouldn't it? And the extent to which that needs to be embodied in particular figures, you know, perhaps like Blair in the early New Labour period managed to embody it. I think it's right. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here is a kind of emotional response to circumstances. But I mean, emotion is central to human life, and it's central to politics. And I think anywheres often don't really understand that, or don't, you know, I mean, perhaps the more global villager end of you know, the kind of Jonathan Porter's academics who think that you know, because they have all these facts and figures, that therefore people ought to think certain things and behave certain ways. It doesn't work like that. And by the way, I disagree with you. I don't think large-scale immigration has been hugely economically beneficial. It's marginally possibly. I did, as Anthony said, I wrote a book about this. I read all the economics, and actually, even Jonathan Porter's acknowledges that it's pretty mixed. It's slightly regressive. So people at the bottom tend to do less well than people at the top and employers, but. It's a pretty even story. It's hugely beneficial for the immigrants themselves, but not for the already existing population. It isn't. Neither is it a great disbenefit, to be fair. And there isn't a huge amount of evidence of. I mean, there is downward pressure on wages at the bottom, but actually the evidence for, you know, people's wages are 10% lower isn't really there. No doubt, if there hadn't been so much immigration, people's wages would have been a lot higher. I mean, that's a different question. So, I mean, I think. You know, when you know people are often hide behind data, as it were, when actually all they're doing is expressing their own biases and priorities and values. And that, to that extent, I agree with Michael Gove about the, you know, Michael Gove's famous controversial expert point. Of course, he's right in a way. I mean, we're not talking about engineers and hard scientists. You know, the people that design jet engines so that when we're traveling in an aeroplane, it doesn't fall out of the sky. You know, we think they're experts, and we depend on them every second of the day. But people who pontificate, like me, or you know, people in universities, you know, humanity, you know, social scientists and economists, they're massively biased, and you know, and we're right to be sceptical about a lot of the things they say, and they're massively selective in the facts that they use, and you know, there are no objective truths in much of human life anyway. I mean, a lot of it is simply about values and preferences and emotions. I mean, that is the reality. It's not as if emotions are a kind of shadow reality and facts are a reality. Emotions are, if anything, a more important reality. I mean, or an equally important reality, you might say. You were talking about sovereignty. I mean, I do think the sovereignty question is very important, and not just about immigration. I think one of the things I didn't mention, but I could have added to my kind of list of anywhere domination, so many things have been taken out of the normal democratic process, the normal sort of democratic argument, conflict in Parliament and in the media and so on. So many things have been taken out in the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, the European Union took a massive amount out. So to that extent, coming out of the European Union, you know, we're kind of rebooting things. You know, we will have a lot more control. And I think, you know, you've seen it in lots of other areas as well. You know, the independence of the Bank of England, the judicial activism that we've seen. I mean, so lots of... Now, you know, the growth of sort of technocratic power, and you can bet your bottom dollar every technocrat isn't anywhere, if not a global villager. So it's another way of kind of reinforcing anywhere power, you might say. Western Europe, yeah, I mean, I think there are obviously differences between every country. I mean, we've been sort of preserved from this until relatively recently because of first past the post. So, you know, populist parties have been in the parliaments and national assemblies of many countries in Europe now for two decades or more, and actually there's something to be said for that. I mean, it's one of the reasons I was saying earlier, there's something to be said for PR, because it turns kind of often rather ugly trolls into serious politicians. They often, they're faced, you know, like the Finns, or what they're called in Finland, who are, you know, the true Finns. They're not, I think they're just called the Finns now. They had some sort of quite nasty sort of extremist roots, but they became bigger and more moderate. They then went into government, and their support has actually fallen away because they've realised things are more complicated than they thought, and they and that's, you know, and they've matured. I mean, they still, you know, are still broadly populist in their instincts and their policies, but and you know, and it may be that we're going to move in that direction. But I mean, I do think we exaggerate the extent to which populism has had a huge impact in Europe too. I mean, that, you know, those parties are there. The most important single populist act, you might say, in Europe in the last 25 years has actually been Brexit. I mean, there would not have been a referendum without UKIP, and the vote wouldn't have gone the way that it did if not for the fact that, you know, that it gave an outlet to populist, not just populist, you know, perfectly respectable people. Voted Brexit, but
have an alternative. I'll give you.
But I think, I mean, I think we shouldn't just look at the European Union. Despite the fact that, you know, many countries have, you know, 20-30% support for populist or quasi-populist parties, the European Union has not budged on anything significant. On the euro, on the, you know, the kind of auto-liberalism of Germany, which continues to crush the economies of Southern Europe, that all continues. Angela Merkel did not give David Cameron a good enough deal to allow him to win the referendum. There's been very little. I mean, you might say Poland and Hungary. I mean, I don't know, you know, where they've. But I mean, you know, basically the open society, the liberal open society, has held. No country has clamped down on immigration, so far as I'm aware. The populists have actually not had a big effect.
Okay, David, thank you. We've run out of time. We are at a divided political moment, and this could be one of your navigational tools. Thank you very much, David, for a fascinating conversation. We've kind of carried on for hours quite clearly. There are lots more questions, and thank you to the audience for a fascinating lunchtime conversation.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.